momentarily. Thank you all for coming. If you haven't signed in, please make sure to sign in. We'll have this clipboard passed around. And I'm going to click star one and activate the webinar. So.
The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Hello and welcome to today's Elevate Your Climate IQ Speaker Series event. Today we have some very exciting speakers. And first I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Irene Bolland-Nielsen, and I'm the co-chair of Region 2's Climate Change Workgroup, along with John Filippelli, who's here in the room. We welcome everyone who's attended today's event. We also would like to note that today's event is co-hosted by Women in Science and Engineering, and you'll be hearing from Rebecca Hughes shortly. We also are joined today by a number of folks who are webinar participants. And how many folks do we have on the webinar, Elizabeth?
41.
So we have 41 people joining us, many of them from across the country. And the format for today's session will be to start with our first speaker, have a very brief Q&A, and we will take questions from those of you who are on the webinar. So please type in your question, and we'll read it aloud here, so you'll hear us speaking your question. And then we'll have our second speaker and Q&A to follow with a discussion after that. So today's event is entitled Energy Efficiency, Promoting Green Behaviors That Count. And we think this is a very relevant, exciting topic. We want to note that the purpose of this speaking event is education and awareness. And we hope that the title speaks for itself and that we can all elevate our climate IQ. For those of you in Region 2, as you came in, you might have noticed that we have information on our own climate education challenge. And I hope that if you didn't see it on the way in, you'll check out the bar charts that show how many people in your division have participated in the climate education challenge. Taking the challenge means taking a half-day short course on climate education and coming to a speaker event. So that's why it's extremely important that you sign up so that we can give your division credit. And I hope that you'll recruit others in your office to take the climate education challenge. So without further ado, I'd like to pass the mic over to Rebecca Hughes of Women in Science and Engineering.
So first of all, I wanted to thank the Climate Change Workgroup for allowing why to co-host the speaker series. Just very briefly about why. I'm Rebecca Hughes. I'm the chair for Women in Science and Engineering here in Region 2. And really our goals are to further the advancement of women scientists and engineers here at ETA. And a big part of that is updating and expanding the field of knowledge. So every once in a while we're setting up our own programs and just getting going. So we really invite ideas, speaker ideas, all kinds of help we can use. Especially we're looking to build a regional web presence. So if anybody's interested in helping build a fixed place or anything like that, we could really use some help there. So that's all of mine. I just wanted to go ahead and introduce our first speaker, Shaveen. And as Emery mentioned, we'll have two speakers. Shaveen will go first. We'll do a brief Q&A with her, and then Chris will go and brief Q&A with him, and then we'll have a broader discussion after both of them. So Shaveen Atari is currently at Columbia University's Earth Institute and the Center for Research on Environmental Decisions. She has a PhD in Civil and Environmental Engineering and Engineering and Public Policy from Carnegie Mellon, and she holds a Bachelor of Science in Engineering Physics from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her current work focuses on perceptions of energy consumption, motivators and demotivators of action in social dilemma situations. Yep, that's right. She especially focuses on interactions between natural and social systems, particularly human behavior and climate change. So I think without further ado, we'll hear from Jane.
Thank you very much for coming and for inviting me, Daniel and Rebecca. As for the introduction, I'm a postdoctoral fellow at the Earth Institute, and I work on basically the interface of psychology and engineering and what do people think about energy systems. So I'll be talking to you a little bit about the paper. I have one copy if anyone wants one. And I'll also be talking to you about some new results. Very exciting. So who are the major carbon players? The major carbon players are the United States and China, with the European Union and India following. The United States emits 22% of the world's carbon emissions and only has 5% of the world's population. So we really need to solve or think about solving the problem of climate change here and export some of the solutions to other countries. Pakala and Sokolo in 2004 wrote the seminal paper called Stabilization Wedges. So what they basically said was that, you know, let's think about trying to stabilize CO2 concentrations to around 400 or 450 even ppm by 2054. And what they said was that you can think about each of these wedges as a reduction of 1 gigaton of carbon per year. So you have everything from carbon capture and storage, forests and soil, nuclear fission, fuel switching, renewable electricity and fuels, and efficiency and conservation. But what they also said in their paper is that improvements in efficiency and conservation offer the greatest potential to provide a wedge. So of all of these different technologies, all of these different ideas, we really should be putting some focus on efficiency and conservation. So some of the guiding questions that I had when I after I read that paper is, you know, do people understand, you know, how much energy these different devices use? You know, we're in this room. Do you know how much energy is being used by the central AC unit? Do you know how much energy is used by these lights? Energy is very invisible. It gets transformed from one form to another. So it's you know, trying to understand what people, I mean, everything in our lives sort of depends on energy. So what do we understand about these energy systems? So the first question that I had was, if I ask an individual, let's say if I ask you, what is the most effective thing you could do in your life to conserve energy, what would you say to me? And would you be spot on? The second question that I had was, how accurate are people's perceptions about energy consumption? You know, and what are their specific inaccuracies or misperceptions? I then wanted to figure out, what are the characteristics of perception? So a lot of people, before I ran this survey, said, oh, you know, men are going to get it right. They like gizmos. They like technology. Women, you know, they're not really into that type of stuff, so they're going to get it wrong. So basically, what are the characteristics that predict perceptions of energy consumption? How easy are these behaviors for people to do? Like, how easy is it for you to use public transportation or carpool? And finally, you know, are there any differences for what I'm willing to do versus what I want you to do? So those are the sort of questions I would like to walk you through and some of the results. So, you know, looking at people's perceptions of energy and how it relates to climate change is a pretty new area. So I had to sort of go back and dig to try to figure out where else has this matching been used, like trying to figure out whether people's perceptions match reality. And Sarah Lichtenstein et al. In 1978 tried to figure out how people's perceptions of risk relate to what is real. So she asked people in the population about these 30 different causes of death, everything from botulism, smallpox vaccines, tornadoes, homicides, heart diseases, and cancers. So on the y-axis, you have estimated number of deaths per year. So that's what people think. On the x-axis, you have actual number of deaths per year. So what is real? Data that fall along the side of the line right here mean that your perception matches reality. So that means it's good to follow along the diagonal line. What you notice is that for smaller risks, people overestimate the risk. So people think that more people die from these causes rather than what is true. So these larger risks of death, such as stroke, stomach cancer, diabetes, heart diseases, people tend to underestimate the risk. Do you guys have any idea why that might be happening? Exactly. So that's what people in psychology call the availability bias. So basically, every time there's an E. coli outbreak, you know, it hits the front page. You know, people think that the risk of dying from E. coli is much higher than it really is. However, when someone dies of a heart attack, it's not front page news, right? So that's one thing that basically showed one huge finding that showed how people overestimate and underestimate risks of death. So what I kind of wanted to do is recreate the same graph, but for energy. So do people overestimate and underestimate certain types of activities? And what do their biases sort of relate to? So this was an online survey advertised by Craigslist. Now there are much better ways to do online survey work. And these are where the participants came from. The stars indicate where we advertised. So it's not a perfect design. No surveys are perfect. But it's sort of these dots sort of show that there is enough heterogeneity in the sample to sort of say something pretty interesting about it. So now let's start with the first question. What is the most effective thing you could do in your life to conserve energy? What we find is that we have people, let's say, turning off the lights, just conserving energy, driving less, recycling, use efficient technologies, which is great,
sleep more, relax more, and there's just no way I don't know how to do it. So there's a whole spread. But what you notice is that 19.6, so almost 20% of our participants stated turning off the lights. Has been most,
but it may not be the most effective thing.
Welcome to GoToWebinar, Web Events Made Easy.
If you have a contact
person. I'm sorry.
Welcome to GoToWebinar, Web Events Made Easy.
You have perceived rank on your y-axis and actual energy use of BTU per can or bottle on your x-axis. Now what you notice is that individuals think that a recycled aluminum can and a recycled glass bottle require the same amount of energy to manufacture. But in fact, a recycled aluminum can only uses a fraction of that energy, and that's because of the process of smelting, et cetera. So that's another misperception that we found, where recycled aluminum can requires 1/20th the energy of a recycled glass bottle. The interesting thing about this, at least to me, is that in this country, we teach kids ever since they're young, you know, recycle, recycle, recycle. But if you're limited in effort, and you're limited in your own amount of energy that you're willing to expend to recycle, we should really get people to recycle the things that save the most amount of energy, if they're limited in the amount of effort. What I'm trying to say is that it's great to recycle everything as much as you can, but if you're limited effort, try to recycle aluminum more than glass. We then ask people, again, just rank order. So basically tell me what's most, least, middle, et cetera, modes of transportation. So amount of energy that goes into transporting 1 ton of goods for 1 mile. On the y-axis, again, you have perceived rank. On the x-axis, you have BTU per ton mile. And again, data that falls along this dashed line means people's perceptions match reality. So people do get that airplanes use the most amount of energy. That's great. However, they incorrectly believe that a truck uses the same amount of energy as a ship or a train, when in fact a truck uses 10 times the amount of energy as a ship or a train to transport 1 ton of goods for 1 mile, on average. So if Amazon ever were to make this, allowance where when you bought a book, you could either get it shipped to your house via a train or a truck, people wouldn't know which one would save more energy for them. So that's another misperception that we found. And now this is sort of the recreation of the big Lichtenstein graph. Again, on the y-axis you have perceived energy used to save, and this is in watt hours. And on the x-axis you have actual energy used to save, again in watt hours. This is the diagonal line where perceptions match reality. Now what do you see initially? So people tend to overestimate slightly some of these small energy users, but they severely underestimate the large energy users. And note that this is a log-log scale. So for example, let me just point you to two specific devices. Let's look at laptops, for example. So laptops, people on average, this is an average of 505 participants, think that a laptop uses twice the amount of energy that it actually does. So it's a small overestimate. If you were to look at, let's say, the dishwasher, people underestimated by 800 times. So what that means is that people do get the small behaviors right, roughly, but they really significantly underestimate the large behaviors. And there are a variety of reasons for this finding. So in pre-testing the survey, we had to provide people with an anchor. We had to tell them, all right, this is the unit that you should be comparing all of these other devices to. So what we did give them was a 100-watt light bulb being left on for an hour uses 100 units of energy. How many units of energy would these different devices take? But we did that because in pre-testing, in doing open-ended interviews, the 100-watt light bulb serves as a natural reference point for people. So because it's physically easy to see, it's very well labeled, so people really understand lighting. They understand the light bulb. But they don't understand some of these other behaviors, these other devices, and how much energy goes into them. But what you also notice is people do rank order them correctly. So they do know that a dishwasher uses more energy than a laptop, but they don't know by how much. And that's what we need to correct. So if we were forming a campaign, what we need to do is sort of grab onto this curve and pull it up towards the diagonal line. Does that make sense? Everyone on board? All right. So then I wanted to predict, who are these people that have better perceptions of energy consumption? Who have worse perceptions of energy consumption? What you notice is that gender does not play a role. So, women and men, it doesn't make a difference. But what does make a difference is that if you have poor environmental attitudes, so if you have poor environmental attitudes and if you are numerous, which is basically your ability to deal with numbers. So if you have poor environmental attitudes and if you can deal with numbers well, that means you have better perceptions of energy consumption. So that's the stuff in color, which is statistically significant. Well, what we also found, which is really, really surprising, is that people that currently do some of these environmental behaviors have worse perceptions of energy consumption, right? So what that means is that I might perceive myself as being an environmental activist, or I might do some of these behaviors, but I might be focusing on the behaviors that I currently do and discounting these other behaviors. So that leads me to having warped perceptions of energy consumption. But that's something we still need to test and figure out why that's happening. So now for some new results, never before seen. So we asked people, you know, how easy or difficult are these behaviors to do? So Paul Stern and Jerry Gardner had this paper called the Short List, the most effective behaviors that you can do. So we asked them, you know, how easy are these behaviors? Now think about cost to you, think about hassle, think about time, think about effort it would take. Think about all of these different things that go into, that motivate or demotivate people to do some of these behaviors. And how hard are these behaviors for you to do? And so here you see around 15 of these behaviors that are mentioned in the short list. What's the first thing you notice? The first thing you notice is that neither easy nor hard, and everything to the right of it is empty, right? So people don't find these behaviors extremely hard to do. They don't find them somewhat hard to do. They don't find them neither easy nor hard to do. They find all of these behaviors relatively easier than others. But why aren't they doing them? So that's what we need to figure out, is that if people generally find these behaviors easy to do, why aren't they doing them? And there's a whole variety of reasons why we can talk about them, such as social norms, right? My neighbor's not doing them. The government needs to sort of help me do these behaviors. They need to create, you know, policies to do them, and I know you guys are working on that. Thank you. But even if you were to look at these, we can categorize them into two separate categories. Super easy behaviors that are in black and, easy behaviors in blue. What we should try to do is also get the behaviors that are higher up on the y-axis. And the y-axis is basically actual percentage of energy saved. What a lot of us have been focusing on, a lot of marketing folks have been focusing on, and sustainability folks, is the curly light bulb. And what that means is that I'll put in one curly light bulb, and I might feel like I'm off the hook. I've done my part. Now I can ride my Hummer from home to the grocery store and ride back, but I have a curly light bulb. What we call that in psychology is a single action bias. So I feel like I've done my part, and I can move on. But my one recommendation to people that are making campaigns is to stop focusing on the light bulb. I think we've got that. There's government regulation coming into place that's going to phase out incandescents real soon, that I'm sure you all have been working on as well. Let's try focusing on the behaviors that are higher up on that list, and let's try to figure out how to get people to do more of these behaviors, not just one or two of them. So this sort of stems into a new project that I have that's a little bit tricky to figure out, is that we need to figure out when people fall into the single action bias mode or when they fall into an avalanche effect. So the single action bias, as I just described to you, is you do one behavior, you feel like you're off the hook. The avalanche effect is, all right, you do one behavior, you feel really good. There's this psychological phenomenon called warm glow. You feel great. You do another one, you feel even better. And you keep doing these until you move from a pretty high CO2 emission per capita to a lower CO2 emission per capita. And that's kind of a social change that we need to figure out. What triggers that? What motivates that? And what leads to people falling into one bucket versus another? But these behaviors are easy. We need to figure out how to get people to do them. We then asked, when the paper came out, the CNAS paper that I walked you through, a lot of the media said, oh, people are clueless. They all think about turning off the lights. You know, people just don't understand energy. But the thing is, I don't think people are clueless. So, in survey, a lot of work sort of needs to be done as to how the problem is framed, how the question is framed. So when we had asked the question, we asked, what is the most effective thing you could do to conserve energy? We then followed that up, and this is a new survey. Is what is the most effective? What is the most effective thing you think Americans could do to conserve energy? So we're just looking at those two questions, right? And so these are the results. You have again everything from turn off the lights, driving less, recycling. There's just no way, I don't know how, and phase out inefficient technologies. Now let's just focus on the top three, which is turn off the lights, drive less, and shut off appliances. Now, you can think of turning off the lights and shutting off appliances as pretty similar. So let's group those together. And now let's look at what we find. Now, all of those reasons have been grouped into this three by three table. So you have, this is what they said for themselves, what they want to do, and this is what they said for other Americans, right? So there's an asymmetry here. So individuals who choose the harder behavior for themselves want the other person to do the harder behavior, which is basically carpooling, driving less, public transportation. However, if I choose the easier behavior for myself, turning off the lights when I'm the last to leave the room, I want you to do the harder behavior. I want you to carpool. I want you to drive less. Take public transportation. I don't want to do it. And that's what this asymmetry is right here. So what this means is that I'll do the easy thing, you do the hard thing. And again, how do we get at that? How do we, I mean, if these behaviors are easy for people to do, people have these misperceptions. If people want to do the easier behavior compared to other people, how do we sort of address that problem in order to get people to willingly accept some of these regulations, willingly accept some of these efficiency changes? So that's also a big surprise finding. We then asked people, all right, what is the most important problem for America today, the world right now, America in the future, and the world in the future, from these four, the economy, healthcare, terrorism, and climate change? What we find is for America right now, the economy is really, really, really important. But what we also find is for the world in the future, climate change is really important. So what do we need to do? We need to speed up time. We need to make the future happen now. So this is another one of my crazy ideas, is we need to compress time. That's a case for virtual reality. We only have one physical world, which you all are helping to protect. Thank you. But virtual reality allows us to create a copy of the world and speed up time and sort of, you know, model some of the impacts of climate change and make it very visual, very visceral to people so that they can sort of understand what these impacts are going to be. Granted, there's a lot of uncertainty. Granted, some of these impacts are very complicated to model. But we have a lot of people that are very interested in this idea. So for example, Google Earth has this feature where you can overlay layers. So I could be standing right here, 290 Broadway, and watch sea level rise based on layering in Google Earth. But it's a very static game, right? So we want this game to be very dynamic. How do we do it? So that's one of the projects I'm working on at Columbia. And basically, will visualizing and virtually experiencing some of these impacts lead people to change their beliefs, change their attitudes, be willing to accept a carbon tax, and so on and so forth? So in terms of conclusions, what is the most effective action? A lot of people state curtailment. However, experts recommend energy efficiency. There are major misperceptions. People have small overestimates for low energy behaviors, but significant underestimates for high energy behaviors. And those are similar biases to the Lichtenstein paper. People think that a train uses the same amount of energy as a truck or a ship to transport 1 ton of goods per mile, when in fact a truck uses 10 times the amount of energy. People think that a recycled bottle requires the same amount of energy as a recycled aluminum can to produce, when in fact a recycled glass bottle uses 20 times the amount of energy. Who are these people that have better perceptions and worse perceptions? If you're pro-environmental and if you understand numbers, and these are basic numbers, if you understand numbers, you have better perceptions of energy consumption. However, if you currently do some of these behaviors, you have worse perceptions. And one possible reason is the focusing effect, but we still need to figure that out. Most participants found these 15 behaviors really easy to do. So we need to focus on the behaviors that save a lot of energy versus little energy and not let people feel like they're off the hook. Again, people think, I'll do the easy thing, you do the hard thing, or we'll both do the hard thing together. And so people are motivated to list easier behaviors for themselves and harder behaviors for other people. There are many reasons that could sort of go into that. We need to figure out what these reasons are and try to address them, try to figure out how to make people feel like we're all in this together and we're trying to prevent defection and this tragedy of the commons. So in terms of future work, how can we improve lay perceptions of energy consumption and facilitate energy conservation? And Chris, this is hopefully a good way into your talk. So real-time energy feedback via smart meters coupled with behavioral interventions might be a good idea. And so there are a whole variety of ways that psychologists have shown that, you know, can facilitate energy conservation. So you have frequent, you know, information, how long you provide the information for, the type of information. So have any of you guys seen the smiley face versus the frowny face by O-Power? Yeah. I'll be talking a little bit about that. Getting people to publicly commit to decreasing energy consumption. setting a goal, providing information. All of these things actually lead to facilitate conservation of energy. So this is the idea from OPower, which is this company that used social comparison to reduce electricity consumption by 2% by just providing people at the end of the month with a smiley face versus a frowny face if they used more energy than average or less energy than average. That led to a decrease of 2% of energy use per month. If this was done nationwide, this would be equivalent to 2.2 million cars off the road. That's a lot. So how can we increase this 2% and sustain that change? And hopefully Chris will tell us how to do that. But before that, I would like to thank all of the great people that have sort of guided some of this research and open it up to some questions. Thank you. No, I don't. So we actually had data for plastic, but with every added question, your response quality kind of goes down. So we actually want, I mean, our big chunk was trying to get at this data. So that's why we just stuck with aluminum versus glass. But what I do know is that the amount of energy you save by recycling aluminum is the most even compared to plastic or glass. So if I were to venture as to where it would fall, in terms of actual, I think it would probably be rent with glass or lower.
During your research anyway, did you come across sort of a comparison? I know this has been sort of an ongoing discussion. If it's better to use a plastic bag or a paper bag?
Bring your own bag. Sure. The question was whether you should bring a plastic or paper bag. I say that as a joke, but let me tell you just a short, quick story about that. So there was this article in the New York Times maybe about a month ago about guilt and energy consumption. And it was about this couple living in Colorado. They lived off the grid, but their one thing was paper diapers. They couldn't get away from it, right? If you were to do a life cycle assessment of a paper diaper versus a cloth diaper, it's a wash. That sounded really weird. Because if you value water a lot versus if you value landfilling, I mean, so paper versus plastic, it kind of depends what you value and what your weighting function is. But, you know, just bring your own bag. It'd be good.
The graph that says that other people to do the hard thing, it dawns on me that maybe an issue of when you ask people if they drive better than average, you know, 78% of people are better than average drivers. So that may be they feel that they already drive as little as they can, but they think the other guys can cut down. So that's a place where maybe the comparison to average, like the OPower, would fit in, because that may be what you're seeing. You know, in their mind, they're already driving as little as they can.
So we don't actually ask them in the question, what is it that you currently do? It's just basically, what do you think it is, you know, what do you think is the behavior that is the most effective? But to get at your question, we actually asked in our survey, do you use more energy than average or less energy than average? And 85% people said that they use less energy than average. That does not make sense.
but you get an answer when you ask them how the drivers they are, too.
Absolutely.
Absolutely normal.
It's you're absolutely right. But there's also this perception piece, right? But I mean, turning off the lights is really easy. Shutting off appliances is really easy. But using public transportation or carpooling is hard, you know? So how do we get people from, instead of asking other people to do the right thing, have them feel like they're part of the solution and get them to also incorporate those changes? Yep.
What are your thoughts on the relationship between energy efficiency and usage? So, for example, the lighting becomes more efficient, and we have LED lights. I'm beginning to see entire buildings that size retrofitted with LED lights purely for decoration. Or in the case of cars, more efficient cars maybe could promote people using cars more.
Right. That's a great question. So,
summarize
the question. Okay, so the question was roughly. You put it so well. the relationship between efficiency and curtailment, which is basically, you know, a lot of people are trying to do efficiency. What does that lead into in terms of behavior? Now, we're really worried about rebound and substitution effects. And what this means, it's lingo from economics, what that means is that, you know, if you get the fuel-efficient car or if you get the energy-efficient washer, it's actually shown that you will drive more or use the washer more. I don't know how people can use a clothes washer more than they usually do. So what we really need to do in this realm is not only get people to adopt the most energy efficient technologies, but then once they do, get them to curtail. So not only are you getting them, it's like a double dividend, it's efficiency and conservation, right? So not only are you getting them to use these LED lights, but there's no reason why the Time Warner building that's not in use should have lights on throughout the night, right? Even if they're LEDs.
I want to quickly go to the webinar and see if people have questions on the webinar.
Yes. The question is coming from Keith Miller. He says, you note that although people think curtailment is more effective than efficiency improvement, experts think that efficiency is better. However, he asks, what about the rebound effect of increased efficiency? In other words, that efficiency leads to reduced prices, which encourages people to consume more, which is happening with transportation. Cars are more efficient, but what about people driving more?
He read your mind. So I think I just addressed that.
And Daniel Gordon asks, the form of our communities physically encourages driving, which makes utilization of public transportation challenging and even prohibitive. How can we actually get people to drive less, provided the inherent difficulty in the structure of our community?
That is a great question, Gordon. So I think that we need both people's willingness to change, as well as them being willing to change their lives in a way that may not allow them to do a lot of the things that they currently do. One problem that I face a lot is whenever I talk about energy efficiency and conservation, you know, people turn around and they point the finger at me. I fly a lot because I'm asked to go to conferences, present research. And so there's this classic ad hominem problem where, you know, it's a character assault. But I think in order to sort of address this problem, we're going to need system changes. We're going to need people to telecommute. We're going to need people to, you know, have an online system. So if I'm going from New York to D.C., I can just, you know, get into a bus with 10 other people. And I think that we're seeing that happening more and more. So especially between New York and D.C., you know, Megabus, Bolt Bus provides a cheaper, more cost-effective option. And I think the trains are still failing. So, you know, to book a round trip train ride between here and D.C. is still very prohibitively expensive. So we need to figure out how to cost these things better. And I think one of the reasons why we find a lot of these misperceptions of energy is because we have sort of an artificially low energy price. I know it's very controversial to say that in this crowd, but I mean, unless we price it right, we're not providing any additional incentives for people who are especially motivated by economics to incorporate some of these behaviors. And so, you know, we can try as much as we can to use these social psychological phenomena, like the smiley face, like these other things, but it's small change compared to this big stuff. Yep. That's a great question. So the question was, are there any differences of age and gender? We actually find that there are no differences between age and gender, which was a very fascinating finding. And this is a very data-rich, like we have a lot of power in some of these results, like statistical power, that's what I mean, because it's a very large sample. So I think that instead of making, like tailoring some of these interventions to specific audiences, I think we need to change what we're telling people. And that's stop focusing on the light bulb, try to get some of these other behaviors and try to create the avalanche effect.
As far as recycling aluminum versus the glass, you were talking about, it, you know, it's a lot of effort to do both or do everything, you know, on the aluminum is better. Have you considered trying to partner, or like it seems like for municipalities, this would be something that would be really useful to know, because I know a lot of towns
Again, that's a great question. What actually happens is that this is corrected by the market. So when there's a recession, people stop recycling paper, they stop recycling glass, but aluminium recycling still continues. So I think the recyclers know about this. It's the people that don't. Yes?
Matt, along those lines, a number of years back, New York City tried to stop glass recycling because they didn't think it was really adding much benefit. And you couldn't stop it. People just kept recycling glass.
But it's still an energy savings. It's just not as much as aluminum. So still recycle, you know, but...
But the people who recycled, that was part of their behavior. Couldn't get them to stop.
One more question.
I was just thinking, you know, we're trying to get at people's motivations and trying to get them to have, you know, change their habits and behaviors. Were there any survey questions to the effect of, you know, what prompted them to start recycling or what's their motivation for the environment?
Another great question, and we're actually studying that right now. So there's another presentation that I could have given you that looks at a simple social dilemma, what motivates and demotivates action. And what a social dilemma is where private interests are at odds with collective interests. So basically, there's no reason why I should conserve energy if energy is super cheap. Not in New York City. I know it's like 20 cents per kilowatt hour. But, you know, if energy is super cheap, there's no advantage for me to conserve. However, if I think about the collective, then it is advantageous for me to conserve because it prevents the tragedy of the commons. And so there are a whole variety of reasons that go into why people defect or cooperate in these types of social dilemmas. And we're trying to disentangle that. But a few ideas are, you know, people feeling like they're a drop in the bucket. People feeling like they can free ride on other people's sacrifices. So there are a whole variety of, like, you know, the cost-benefit ratio. It's not cost-effective for me to donate to NPR, even though I listen to NPR all the time. And the same thing that goes for blood donation, right? So I always rely on the blood bank being full whenever I need blood, but I don't want to donate blood. So that's the same type of example, but we can talk about that after. Thanks.
Thank you, Shazeen. We're going to hold the questions there for now, but we'll pick up with more discussion after our second presenter. Before we get to that, I just want to remind everyone in the room to make sure you sign the sign-in sheet before you leave. I think we have it circulating. We have the sign-in sheet being passed around. Okay. And so for those of you in the room who don't know me, I'm Daniel Teitelbaum. I'm here on a detail from headquarters helping out with the climate change work group. And I'm very pleased to present our second speaker, Chris Gazy. Chris Gazy manages Con Edison's Targeted Demand Side Management Program, which is a $150 million energy efficiency program intended to reduce load growth and defer infrastructure investments. Chris holds an MBA from Columbia Business School. And prior to attending business school, Chris worked for 6 years as a nuclear safeguards inspector at the IAEA. He is an expert in nuclear nonproliferation, occasionally consults for Brookhaven and Los Alamos National Labs. And in addition, he teaches a graduate seminar at Columbia University on prospects for nuclear power. So please welcome Chris Gazy.
I think we're good. Can everybody hear me? I think this talk will follow nicely with the last one because we talked about sort of people's perceptions and behaviors. One of the things that I deal with day in and day out managing an energy efficiency program at a utility is how the economics factor into that. And sometimes it's at odds economically what we should do with what people would want to do otherwise. So I wanted to walk you today through a couple different topics. First, just a little background on sort of the energy efficiency realm, what the states are doing, what the utilities are doing. And I know a lot about what Con Edison is doing. I've had some exposure to what the other states and utilities are doing. So I can comment a little bit on that. And I'd like to talk to you about some of the value streams that come from efficiency that are more than just the money you save on your bill, how we as a utility might see it and how that affects some of the choices. And then I'll give you a little background on some of the efficiency programs that are running out there, how utilities build these, and we can sort of see how that meshes with what people want or don't want to do. And then finally, let's talk about some of the barriers to energy efficiency that we see administering these programs day in and day out. So the first slide here is an interesting, this question was asked recently, how does energy efficiency compare with other things that are out there in terms of other energy sources? And I think this gets at the heart of why energy efficiency is such a good thing to do, because it's the cheapest way that we can provide the energy we need as a society. If you look at the graph on the on your right, you'll see things like combined cycle power plants and solar photovoltaics costing $75, $100, $200 a megawatt hour in order to produce electricity, whereas energy efficiency is typically a comparable cost, 2 to 6 cents per kilowatt hour, and that translates to $20 to $60 a megawatt hour. So it's the cheapest thing we can do, and conserving energy is the same as generating it when it comes down to it. So if you conserve and somebody else uses a little more, that's the same as us generating and you using the same and somebody else using a little more. So this is why utilities are so focused on it and states are so focused on it. It's just the cheapest thing out there. And also, one of the arguments that you increasingly hear people in the energy efficiency community and the states making is that solar and things like that are great, renewable energy is great, but before we do that, we shouldn't put solar panels on the roof to heat a house and let all that air, you know, warm air go out the leaky windows and everything else in the house. That doesn't make any sense to spend a lot of money to generate that nice clean energy and let it leak out the envelope of the house. So the mantra now is that we should do efficiency first, and then we should spend the money on these renewables. So that's something that's driving states and utilities. Just to give you an example of how these things are being put together now, a lot of states have implemented what we call energy efficiency portfolio standards or some other kind of mandate. And basically what that says is that we want to reduce consumption, and we've set a goal. In New York State, it's 15% by 2015. And then, of course, you need to figure out how do we do that. Well, one of the ways we do it is we put a little surcharge on your electric bill. We collect some money through that, and we give it to NYSERDA, which is the agency in New York, or the utilities in New York, to implement energy efficiency programs. So the utilities and state agencies around the country take that money that's collected, and we find some way to influence our customers to implement energy efficiency. And that's basically what I do day in and day out. And the programs are, by and large, typically built around the idea of I'm going to bribe you somehow to implement energy efficiency. I'm going to subsidize the cost. I'm going to do something else that makes it worth your while to change your lights, change your mostly your air conditioner, change your motors to new, more efficient motors. The other way that we can go about this, though, that doesn't involve bribing people is to increase make more strict codes and standards. So if I want to renovate a building or build a new building, if I want to buy a new car, the CAFE standards are going up. So manufacturers are going to have to make those cars more fuel efficient. Builders are going to have to make buildings more efficient. You can't buy or use certain kinds of lighting anymore in a new building or a retrofit building. You have to improve it to code. And that's great because it gets at that new segment, but it doesn't help us with what's already there, the existing fleet of cars or the existing building stock we have. And then the last thing that was referred to is this behavioral idea of employing sort of normative comparisons to your peers and getting you to change your behavior. And that's a new phenomenon probably over the last couple of years in energy efficiency, and it's a good thing. And there are problems with it, and I'll talk a little bit about both of those. So this is sort of how the climate is, and it's the same in other states. I went to the ACEEE conference, the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy summer study this year, and people from all over the country came and presented variations of these kind of programs and ideas. Let's talk a little bit about how we value efficiency. You as a customer would change your light bulb and value that on the savings that you get from that action. But the interesting thing is that when you put in that CFL and reduce 100 watts of or 50 or 60 watts of consumption, all of a sudden we don't need such a robust system to transmit that energy to you because you're all collectively using less. So we don't have to build as much infrastructure and put it in the ground. Because we don't transmit that energy, of course, when we transmit it, we lose a little bit in the process, in the wires. and that efficiency is lost or is saved. So you can see that it ripples all the way back through the value chain. We don't have to build as many power plants, and ultimately, because we don't build as many power plants and burn as much fossil fuels, we don't put as much carbon in the environment. So while you might only see this first piece under energy savings, the utility and other stakeholders, the states and society, looks at the entire benefit as it goes back through the value chain. And again, that's why efficiency is such a good investment and such a good thing to do, because you're all the way at this end of the value chain, and everything you do goes all the way back through to the beginning of it. Just to give you an idea of how we think about this in terms of from a utility perspective, we think about it a little differently than other people do, because we look at what we have to build to transmit the energy to you. So, and to put some numbers on this and give you an idea, these are all examples. They vary from action to action. But if I, for instance, change the lights in a commercial facility that's, you know, running 12 hours a day, you know, the business hours are 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., per kilowatt that I reduce that, I can save $1,900 a year. If we use the numbers that New York uses and the State Public Service Commission has put out there, I save $600 a year on building new power plants. I avoid $200 worth of line losses in transmitting that power. If I happen, and this is an example here, I happen to have a distribution project that I would have to do to reinforce the grid to bring that extra power to you, but now you're not using it, I could save money there. And there's an environmental benefit in terms of putting a price on that CO2. We add that up and we say that the entire benefit then is $3,500 per kilowatt. That's actually a lot. So we look at it then and say, I can spend up to that amount to incent you to take that action, and it's cost effective. If it costs me more than that, it's not. And you can look at some other solutions like putting in distributed generation. In this case, I've chosen a combined heat and power example, where you can also generate a similar amount of value, but in this case, the price is higher. It's $2,500 to implement instead of, say, $1,300. So you still get a positive benefit to cost ratio, but it's not as big. And then demand response, which is what DR stands for, is a curtailment example. You still generate benefits, but again, and the whole thing is much cheaper. It's only $600 a kilowatt in this example, but the benefit falls in between. So from a purely economic perspective, I would look at this example and I would say, well, I should do the lighting first, because it provides the biggest economic benefit. And once I've done all the lighting, then I should get as much demand response as I can do, and then after that I should go after the combined heat and power. Now, our programs aren't designed that way. We go after multiple things at once, but you know, we do struggle with this idea of what's the most economic thing to do, having a sensitivity towards how much it costs you as consumers in your electric rates. The other thing that this slide has that I want to comment on briefly is, who benefits from these different savings? Well, in terms of energy savings, you as the customer pay less on your utility bill, so you benefit in that from the energy savings. The other three, power plants built, line losses avoided, transmission and distribution reinforcement avoided, the utility benefits from that, so we capture that, and of course it gets passed back on to you because we don't spend it. But it makes an interesting thing if you add up capacity, line losses, and transmission and distribution, you sometimes don't get enough to justify the cost. So sometimes it's cheaper to do another action if you look at it from just the utility point of view or just the consumer point of view. But if you look at it from a societal point of view, it does make economic sense. And this is why we have these mechanisms and programs where we can take that broad view and justify the whole societal value and recover that little bit of extra money that it costs in your bill and make it happen. That's sort of a individual versus a collective.
Excuse me, what would this societal cost line, what does that mean?
That's how much it costs to implement it. So how much the utility pays, how much the consumer pays, and how much it costs us to administer the program. So that's all the costs that might go into making that. Yeah, it could. It would cost $1,300 per kilowatt. to implement that lighting project. But you would generate $3,500 of economic value. So it's a purely economic analysis. I'm going to skip this one because this isn't so relevant to what we're talking about now. So how do utilities typically then put together programs given this economic analysis that I showed you? Well, despite the fact that some things are much more economic than others, we try to design programs that get breadth and depth of savings. So we try and target all the different things we can. We try and target the commercial and industrial, C&I sector, residential, multifamily, data centers, hospitals. We try to put programs out there that touch every sector we can. And then, of course, we push for new construction codes to hit that market. And then the existing stuff we call the retrofit market. And that's where we put those incentives out there. And then, again, to get the depth of savings, if I'm going to go and interact with a customer and convince them to do a lighting job, is it possible to also convince them to look at their air conditioning and their motors and the other actions that they do? And a lot of people from a marketing perspective might say once you've got them engaged, you want to follow through and get everything you can out of them. And so that's this idea of depth of saving. And that's actually at odds with the idea of getting the most we can, the biggest bang for the buck. And so that's where there's a difficulty in sort of do we do all the light bulbs first or do we convince people to do the other things? You might not have a second chance to convince them to do the other things, so maybe from a long-term perspective, you want to go after that anyway. And that's where most state and utility programs come down, is we should get breadth and we should get depth. So as I said, we offer free or subsidized audits to identify opportunities and then financial incentives to basically buy down the cost of implementing this action. So buy down the cost of the lighting project or changing out your air conditioning or something like that. In a lot of cases, especially with commercial customers who look at this in an economic perspective, we try and move that payback period. How long does it take you to save enough money in your utility bill to pay for what your share of the cost? We try and move that to the one-year point, because then it goes from being a capital cost to you, a long-term cost, to being an operational cost. You would have spent that $1,000 anyway on electricity. Instead, you spend it on something that you recover in that first year, and then every year after that, you save that $1,000. So this is the idea. If you can get it to that point, it makes it easier for people to make the decision to do it. We also are looking at behavioral programs. This is something new. We talked about O-Power and how they do things. And so typically what they'll do is they'll send you out, where they'll have a separate mailing that says, here's the average for people like you. It could be your neighbors or it could be just other people like you that they've identified. And here's where you fall. And as we heard from the last talk, most people think they're better than average. So if you get the bill and you look at it and it says that you're not better than average and you thought you were, you're motivated to get yourself to be better than average. So in that sense, it works. And they've got very good statistics. Our problems with it are how are those savings being achieved? Is it curtailment or is it energy efficiency? Because if it's curtailment, maybe you have to remind them every year by sending out these mailings and getting them to come repeatedly back to the website. And is that sustainable, both from a cost perspective and from the action perspective? So this is the piece of the whole behavioral thing that's missing. It seems like it's got a lot of promise, but nobody yet has data on the persistence of what people do. And the last thing that's sort of coming in the future is, some of it's here now, but some of it's in the future, is the whole idea of a smart grid. And the idea here is that you put in a meter that gives people real-time pricing, for instance, because electricity is more expensive at peak times in the afternoon than it is in the middle of the night. And hopefully that'll drive them, one, to use electricity in off-peak periods when it's cheaper, which reduces costs for everybody. And it also enables a lot of things like smart appliances, where the utility company can talk to the appliance and tell it to, run a little bit less because we've got a lot of demand on the system right now. And it saves money that way, and it can save energy that way. You might envision in the future a building control system that talks to the utility and manages the temperature in that building. It could cool in the morning on a hot day and then use that energy throughout the day when it would be expensive. And more, also peak energy tends to be more polluting because you have everything running at the time, whereas in the night or in the morning you might be wind power or you might be more nuclear or something that's cleaner. So those are all things that are sort of coming in the future with smart grid. And the question is, and we'll see this in a second, how effective are those things going to be? So what are the barriers? That gives you an idea of what the landscape is, how we operate and how we run these programs and how we try and get people to adopt energy efficient both behaviors and technologies. Probably the main barriers are split incentives. And everybody's familiar with this problem where I rent the apartment, but I don't pay the utility bill. So, you know, the air conditioning's free for me. I stay in a hotel room for the night. I paid a flat rate for that hotel room. I want to run the air conditioner at full blast for the whole night, right? That's how we think as people. And so there's a split incentive there. How do we get people to conserve or take actions to implement energy efficiency technologies when they might not benefit? Or we have to get landlords and tenants to agree how to split the costs and the benefits of that action. Another good example of the split incentive is in data centers, you have a chief information officer who's responsible for buying those servers, and all they care about is that they run and they're up, and they don't care about how much energy they use because the energy bill gets sent to the chief operating officer, and he pays it. And so one guy can make all the decisions about what's used that affects the energy demand, and somebody else picks up the bill. And that's a problem we have getting data centers to implement energy efficiency is convincing these two guys in the C-suite to talk to each other. Economic issues are probably, though, the biggest problem that we see out there, especially in the commercial sector. Energy is typically a smaller, non-core expense. If I run a mom-and-pop grocery store, and energy is 5% of my cost structure, and in times like these, am I really focused on energy, you know? And then if somebody comes along and says, hey, there's a utility program out there that'll pay 70% of the cost of upgrading to energy-efficient lighting or air conditioning, and all we need from you is $5,000, and I might say, I don't have it. I get it. I understand it's a great thing to do. I understand this opportunity is limited. But in this economic climate, I just don't have $5,000 to put into that. If I had it, I'd do something else that I need to do for my business. So that's probably the biggest problem, especially right now, in terms of getting these programs to be successful. And, you know, people don't want to be bribed right now. They can't be bribed. They want to be bribed, but they can't be bribed. Long payback for some measures. When we talk about the things that are difficult to do, that give you the bigger savings, like buying a new refrigerator. The payback on that might be 20 years. You'll save a little energy, and if everybody did it, we'd save a lot of energy, but it would take 20 years to build up enough savings to justify that expense, and that's a hard sell, a very hard sell. So, you know, given all those things, people are trying to find mechanisms to get around these barriers, like financing, to get around the upfront capital costs. We need mechanisms to do this. There was an initiative called PACE where you basically pay for it and it gets put on your property taxes so it stays with the house or the building. There are challenges getting that implemented, but it's a great new idea. On-bill financing is another thing that might work, although that has its own problematic aspects. One of the challenges that I find working with especially small businesses are the size of the upfront payment that the business owner has to put out there might only be $2,000 or $3,000. It's even too small for PACE. You know, typically that's something you put on your Visa bill. And is a business owner willing to run up their Visa bill for something like this, or can they even? It's not the kind of thing you can go out and get equipment financing for because it's just too small. It costs too much for the lenders to underwrite each of these different small expenditures 1,000 times. If you have, you know, a $2 million project, you can go find financing for that these days in energy efficiency. So that's a challenge. And one of the other big things, and the Department of Energy has made this very, very clear to us at this meeting last summer, was that we need to prove that these bill savings exist and what they are. And this is challenging because energy prices rise and fall, energy use changes with weather. So you can do, you can implement an energy efficiency project and then have a hot month next month and use more energy, and you look at your bill and you say it went up. You know, and you can't understand why it went up when you did all these energy efficiency actions. Well, just because there's a natural fluctuation there, and it's very hard to pull out the energy efficiency savings from the natural variations in electricity bills especially. So that's a challenge. Consumer preferences are a challenge. You're not going to shine CFL light on a $1,000 purse or a $10,000 Gucci watch. The retailer will tell you, I'm going to put as much light on that as I want, and I'm going to put whatever kind of light on that I want because that's how much it costs. People might not dial down their thermostat or sign up for a direct load control of their air conditioner by the utility because they're worried it's going to get too hot and they want it colder. So there's convenience and comfort issues that come in on the consumer side that you just have to deal with. Education and awareness is probably part of it. Energy efficiency is gaining there, but as we heard, a lot of people need to understand what the actions are that make a difference. And then we come to this issue of capturing only the low-hanging fruit, which is the curly light bulbs. This is a hard one because getting people to do just that action could save a lot of energy, and it is the most economic thing to do. But as you heard, we also want people to do the harder things. So that's a barrier that, and if you're a contractor out there administering a utility program and you just want to run those savings through, you know, get those jobs done and make money, the most economic thing to do is to subsidize lighting. Because you might be able to pay a customer 70% of a lighting job, but only 10 or 20% of an air conditioning or motor replacement because one costs much more. And so it's a lot easier to sell customers on, I'll pay 70% of this, and it'll only cost a couple thousand dollars, than I'll pay 20% of this, and it'll cost $100,000. Energy service companies that are out there in the market are obviously pushing the things they can sell easiest. And finally, just a couple thoughts on what will happen in the future with smart grid and things like that. There's going to be a lot of talk around privacy issues with smart grid data. If the utility installs a meter and you install smart appliances and somewhere there's information about when you're home, when you're watching TV, when you go to the refrigerator, when you wash your clothes, all these kinds of things out there, there's going to be a whole lot of privacy questions about that. And the second thing, and that's going to slow the implementation of the smart grid most likely, and the adoption of some of these technologies. And the last thing is, are the savings that you're going to get from paying attention to those real-time prices? So the price of electricity now is 12 cents right now, and it was 10 cents in the morning, and I'm going to use a kilowatt hour, so I'm going to save 2 cents. Do I care? You know, when you think about it that way, it's novel at first. I've got this gadget. I play with it a while, and then a year or two later, do I not care anymore because it's the difference between a dollar or two a month on my utility bill? I have a feeling when it comes to that point, solutions that are automated that take the actions for you and make those decisions for you are going to be great, and solutions that rely on people to care about a couple cents per kilowatt hour difference are not going to be as effective. So I think that's all I have prepared. Let me take a few questions.
Okay.
I just wanted to jump on that last point. If you're saying that you're saving a dollar or two, I mean, if these systems could also, so if you're saving a dollar or two, are there systems that could, that could also show you your whole state is saving this much, based on activities similar to yours. So then you start to see real savings and environmental benefits. Is it possible to kind of combine all the information?
So the question is, if we aggregate the benefits, will people care about them more? And there are some interesting sort of energy efficiency pilots out there where people are like, can we get communities to compete to save energy and things like this, or schools to compete? A colleague of mine called from Oregon the other day, and they were going to set up some kind of get schools to participate, and get all the kids to care so that they're constantly badgering the teachers, turn off the lights, do this, do that. Yeah. And yeah, I think that those are great solutions. And I think that aggregating that and putting it out there will help. But I think in the long run, automated solutions are the best way to go about that.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you mentioned leak, leak, but I think that could be unhealthy in a home. There's always some kind of pollutant generated within the home. And I think all homes should have some kind of air leak to keep fresh air coming in.
For those of you on the webinar, the question is about sealant leaks in the home and whether it's healthy to be keeping all the air in and not circulating.
I'll have to plead innocence or ignorance to the – I don't know because I don't work in that area very much, but I understand your point. You do have to balance the air quality with the energy energy loss. I don't think it's an issue, though, on that scale of air. So I think that's the answer, but I really can't.
I just add to that thought. There is a standard called the passive house standard, and basically it's super insulation. So you have very little airflow throughout the exterior walls of the house, and you bring in air through a ventilation system, and you distribute it throughout the house, and you keep that running at all times. And they did air quality studies such as radon to see if there is any effect. And when you shut off the ventilation system, you're right, the levels of radon would go up because you have no air infiltration through the envelope. But as long as you keep that ventilation system running, you shouldn't have any air quality issues. And it's really big in Germany right now.
And the newer California, there's been studies in California that have shown that you really have to do that. There's too much outgassing of products in the very well sealed homes to allow there to not be engineered ventilation. And they've had problems in more of the houses with Chinese drywall that had very low air exchange rates showed up than houses that had better air exchange rates that still had Chinese drywall. Their problems, they said, had some problems, but they weren't nearly as severe. So it's something that the Europeans have known about for a long time. Many European houses are built with engineered ventilation, and it's still not really done routinely in the U.S. as it should be.
More questions in the room?
You mentioned non-bill financing.
Mm-hmm.
How far away is something like that, particularly for small business? I mean, it might be a way for on-bill financing. That's where the savings will be offset against the usage right on the bill and out-of-pocket expenditures, right?
Yeah. I can tell you my company, the official position is we're not in favor of it at the moment. I think a lot of that has to do with, there are a lot of issues around implementing it, legacy computer system issues and issues about what happens when somebody pays but they don't pay all of it. Are they, do you cut them off because they've paid the utility piece, but they haven't the usage piece, but not for the energy efficiency upgrade piece. So there's issues there that need to be ironed out. But I also know that the state is may mandate it at some point. So it's really in that stage right now where they're working out the details. And
are you reading yourself the compact work and plan? I mean, there is a science lab as an example. They're changing all the lights now with LED, which is very intense, and much brighter than CFL, And they do it for commercial malls,
Yeah.
And they're saving hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The
actually being implemented.
Yeah.
Because the LED is limitation,
Yeah.
That's more all the fuse, for the light.
Yeah. The question is about LEDs, right? Yeah. The question is about LEDs. LEDs are something that both at least at Con Edison and NYSERDA, are watching very carefully because there have been a lot of overinflated manufacturer claims. And some of the early versions haven't worked as advertised. And we're very sensitive to the fact that the CFL industry shot themselves in the foot out of the door because they put a lot of bad product out there and people didn't like them. And then it was harder later to get adoption. So we do support certain LEDs and certain applications. And there's other places where the DOE has shown that fluorescents are better and they're just as, you know, the demand is the same. They use the same amount of energy. So it's something that's emerging, and as the LED manufacturers get better, the technology will get better, and ultimately it will be something that we will pursue, just like we have CFLs.
I have a question about the smart grid, and you mentioned the privacy concerns associated with it. I understand that the smart grid is really a suite of different technologies, behaviors, and actors in order to be successful. So I'm interested if you could talk to what you foresee as our next step with the smart grid, and if there's potential for more pilots to be implemented and where that might be most successful.
I can talk a little bit about Con Edison's view on that at the moment. And Con Edison is different than other utilities in the country because it's a very urban setting. So some utilities are implementing smart grid because it's cheaper to do that and have a smart meter than send somebody a mile between houses to read meters. In New York, that's not the case. So the cost justification isn't as good. And we are also skeptical about how responsive people are going to be to the prices at this point. So we've taken an attitude of we can do things on our side of the meter now and wait and see what the rest of the country experiences and learn from them and then pick an implementation for the customer side of the meter, except for certain pilots that we're running. And when I say our side of the meter, part of smart grid is distributing electricity more efficiently, having self-healing networks, so if a piece of it goes down, you can have automatic switches that route power around it, routing power from overloaded areas to less loaded areas, which cuts down on losses and also improves the reliability of the grid. So a lot of the money, and Con Edison got a lot of smart grid money from DOE in this last round, went to those kind of applications where we installed switches on our equipment to better distribute electricity.
And if I can ask one more question, my second question is about the difficulty in underwriting such small loans. And you mentioned $2,000, which, you know, that home energy auditor just didn't make in that neighborhood, and then $1 million. I'm wondering where that threshold lies, and if there's any financial mechanisms that would bundle these small buildings into a portfolio that might be more feasible for somebody.
Yeah. The threshold, from what I understand, lies in the $5,000 to $10,000 range. I think that's where PACE is getting at. And so that section might end up being well served. And I think it's, you know, if you do a weatherization of your house and you do a whole suite of measures, on a residential scale, you can probably add that up to $5,000 or $10,000 and put it in the PACE vehicle when that's ready. If you're a small business and you're just doing a lighting or something else like that, you might not be able to get there. And so that's really the sector I think that might find it difficult. Or maybe an apartment dweller who can't do anything in the building, they can only do something to their apartment, and they can only do, you know, $500 worth of work or something. Those sectors are really hard to reach, and anybody that's got a good idea for that would be, you know, welcome to suggest it. But Visa type, you know, credit cards are really the way people finance that, because they don't look at, when I go to swipe my card and buy that, you know, new laptop, they don't ask, can he pay for that laptop at the time? They know that I'm authorized some cap and that they're, and they take the losses if some people can't pay, and they do it that way. So you're not going to be able to make the individual call at that level. I think it's just not going to be cost effective.
Other webinar questions?
From Samuel Gordon. He says,
In our office, we are often confronted by utility customers who complain that they reduce their energy consumption with their delivery charge and increase. Could you talk about this paradox?
Yeah. Well, okay, first of all, at least in New York, there's two pieces to your bill. There's the energy you use, and that's built straight through on a, you know, you can either go to a third party and get it, or Con Edison will buy it for you and give it to you at cost. So when I do an energy retrofit and I save energy, it comes out of that piece of the bill. The other half of the bill is what it costs us to deliver electricity, and we're very sensitive to the fact that that is going up, because we're spending a lot of money reinforcing the grid, because people are constantly moving to the city. We're constantly building bigger buildings, and we have a lot of 100-year-old equipment that also is coming due for replacement. And so all those things are putting upward pressure on rates. And that's why, actually, my program looks at how do we defer those investments to control that rise in costs of delivering electricity, because we're very sensitive to it. And just to give you an example, this program that we run, and we look at the demand side, not the energy side of electricity, has saved $223 million in capital costs over the last 5 years. That's $223 million we didn't spend because of, you know, we did it with, you know, we got those gains with efficiency. We slowed the growth with efficiency. So we have an ulterior motive because we're sensitive to that pressure on rates.
Next on the room.
When you transmit electricity through the grid and, you know, from production all the way to consumer, you're losing over 60% of the energy, you know. Have you done any analysis and what do you do about, you know, replacing this grid, you know, transmission grid and transformers and all that? It's an old technology.
Yeah. So the question is, you lose a lot, you lose 60% is the claim between the generation and the customer. That's true. Most of that loss comes at the power plant because that's only one-third efficient. The transmission through the grid is more in the range of 7% losses from the and that varies by utility and by the design of the grid. So that's just a rough rule of thumb number. It's not, it's going to be different with depending on where you are and what utility you're looking at. But it's expensive to replace that equipment. Transformers are millions of dollars a piece. Putting cable in the ground in the city is really expensive. So we try and make the stuff we have last as long as we can. There's a little bit of work upgrading the technology and the configurations of our grid to be more efficient, but it's limited by how much we want to spend on that without increasing rates too much. So that's why we look at other things like can we get efficiency, which as you saw ripples back and reduces that loss that way.
I'm pretty loud. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit. When you think about New York City, it's ultra-urban, and there are a lot of office buildings. And a lot of these office buildings are owned by a landlord, and there are multiple tenants in the business. And I have definitely heard some businesses saying, there's a real issue in using both the other tenants in the building and the landlord to make changes. So you're a great example here. We need to be part of this building. And I'm wondering if you're a lot of work with trying to think out bringing those people together, because I think they may also probably have the means to finance some of these bigger upgrades in the building and also like the building.
Yes. So the question is about, really it's about the split incentive problem in terms of big buildings owned by landlords and leased to corporations and things. And it often depends on the structure of the electricity service. If it's an individually metered business and they pay that electricity bill, then they're going to be interested in the energy, spending money on energy efficiency because they see the savings. If it's a master meter building where, say, some landlord pays the electricity bill for the whole building and they pass that cost on to the tenants, sometimes they tack a little bit on as a service charge to passing on that cost. So you can see that they might have a disincentive for helping their tenants go more efficient. Although, to be honest, the ones we've talked to are generally they want to create a better environment for their tenants, and they're not, you know, looking at it that way. But if it's all part of sort of wrapped up in the rent, now you have the situation where, hey, I paid for the hotel room, I'm going to use as much as I want. I don't have an incentive to spend money, only the landlord does. And the way we get around that is just by trying to design programs that, that reach out to that. So we have a multifamily program where we try and work with landlords and tenants to come to some, you know, to participate in the program and decide on a suite of retrofit lighting and refrigerators and air conditioning and building boilers to see if we can get at that sector. But it's a hard nut to crack is the answer.
At this point, we're going to open it up to see if there are general questions that you'd be interested in hearing from both of our presenters on. So are there any general topics for both Chris and Shazeen? Yes, from the webinar.
One of the questions on the webinar is regarding this idea of the virtual reality that the value of that. How can we create scenarios to conjure up without running the risk of scaring the public or with climate change communication, kind of passing by that threshold of where people feel like they can make a difference into a feeling of powerlessness because of the sheer scale of the impact.
So there are a couple of ways to address that. So one way is the global circulation model at NASA GIS has a whole variety of these different scenarios, and one is just the business as usual scenario. So we're going to be working with them to try to figure out just what the business as usual scenario looks like. But as I said, you know, this game is not going to be a single player static game. It's going to be, we're trying to aim for a multiplayer dynamic game. So basically, if if every minute in the virtual world serves as 10 years in the real world, your actions in every round actually could make a difference. And so there's an example of this, but it's very static. It's called the Climate Challenge, which was done through Red Redemption and BBC World Service. And but it doesn't allow people to sort of feel or see the impact, except for whether you're voted in or voted out of office at the end of 9 rounds. So we're trying to make, I think bringing in people into this situation and also helping people visualize the impact is going to be both beneficial for, how modelers sort of use that data to sort of communicate to the public. Hope that answers it.
This question is from Chris. In other countries like Denmark, they've moved towards mostly distributed generation within their electrical grid. But I see that the short-term payback may not be as high as for efficiency, but is there a long-term benefit to distributed generation?
I think the answer to that is it depends on the application and where you put it. So one of the things we're in negotiation right now with a lot of people from the combined heat and power sector. And we agree with them in a lot of sense that combined heat and power makes sense because you use that heat component. It's more efficient. You can cut down on emissions overall, perhaps. But again, it depends on the application. If you're replacing a really dirty boiler, the local emissions might go down. But you also might raise the local emissions even though you decrease the global emissions. So we really need to be sensitive to the specific application of it and choose the places where it makes sense. On the other hand, a lot of technologies like solar and things like that, as you saw, are expensive and a long way away. So it might make a lot more sense to focus on efficiency right now and put the solar panels in after that. So that's sort of our view on it at the moment.
Other questions in the room? I'll ask just one. I guess in the most general terms, what do you each think is the most important thing that the government can be doing to promote energy efficiency?
That's an interesting question. To promote efficiency.
Yes, and or conservation, but reduction.
You know, that you could say that if we had a national energy policy that sort of had a cap and trade system, that might do it. And I'll have to say I used to deal a lot with the California Low Carbon Fuel Standard, which is on the ballot, I think, Tuesday. And I like that system a lot because it sets a threshold and it tells you who's responsible for it, and it's technology neutral. In other words, the average fuel intensity is 95. It has to go to 87 in 10 years. Here's what everything costs, and you mix it together. So if the baseline is 95 and you mix in some sugar ethanol at 61, you bring down that average. And that, to me, makes a lot of sense. And the blenders are responsible, so somebody has to either do it or buy the credits from somebody else who's done it to make it happen. So I like systems like that because somebody's on the hook. Now, you could argue New York is a leader because we have a 15% reduction by 15 goal, but I asked somebody recently, well, what happens if we don't get that? Who's to blame? Who's responsible? What happens? And nobody had an answer for me. So it's great to have a goal, but there's no guarantee we're going to get there. We're all trying hard, and it's a great goal. And I don't want to put down the people that fought to get it in place, but I like systems where you have some sort of cap and it moves down, like Reggie, for instance. And there's somebody on the hook that has to comply, because then it actually has to happen. So I think more programs where there's a definitive goal and a definitive person responsible, I think, are better than other types.
Sort of similar to what you said, also national regulation. I favor like the carbon tax. That's sort of phased in and then ramped up over time, because I think that sort of is very transparent. It allows especially smaller companies that are working on emerging technologies a very strong price signal to facilitate some of their breakthroughs. And also, like, just having looked at some cap and trade documentation, it's pretty convoluted to be able to sort of try to figure out what's going on. But even if it were cap and trade, I think that's great. We just need something to start it off. And I was at Copenhagen, and it was very painful. I had to leave after a week because I couldn't take it anymore. And I'm probably not going to be going to Cancun because I think that's going to fail as well. I hope it doesn't, but it just seems like we're not making any headway. And since we are at the EPA, I just hope that all of you sort of keep pushing on this issue, and hopefully we can get some regulation soon.
I'm just kind of on top of that, as environmentalists and stewards of the environment, what can we do personally and encourage our friends and family? What would you suggest?
So the question is what we can personally do.
Since you do work at the EPA, the regulations really make a difference. Talk to your friends. People really think that a tax is going to hurt them much more than it really does. Like, so, for example, let's just talk about New York City, since we live and love this place. Bloomberg put a ban on smoking in public places. He also put a ban on trans fats. People before the ban really, did not want it to go through. After the ban, hey, it's fine. So there's this phenomenon, psychological phenomenon, called psychological reactance. So anything that curbs our choice that we really react negatively to. But a tax doesn't actually change your choice set. It just makes it harder for you to do. It's sort of libertarian paternalism. It sort of makes it harder for you to do the thing that's bad for the collective. And I think that's the first thing. In terms of you as a person, I think spreading the word, doing the type of research you do, talking to friends and family, trying to get at some of those harder things on the list that I showed you. I have a copy of my paper and also some of the other papers that talk about what is most effective in terms of climate change, of what you could do to decrease your CO2 footprint. that New Yorkers in general have very low CO2 footprint compared to other cities across the nation and across the world. So in terms of what we can do is, I think, our biggest chunk, or our biggest fruit on the tree is trying to sort of show people how to do it right in the city, in the nation, in the world.
I was going to say, turn the lights out. Drive us. I think, as we heard, there are a lot of actions that you can take that are very easy. You know, going out and buying CFLs is one thing. Buying a more fuel-efficient car next time you go out there and not the SUV is another thing. Changing the filters on your air conditioning and getting it tuned up so that it works right. These are all simple things that you can do to cut your energy use. And to the extent that they're technological choices or things like tuning up a car, I think those are the better choices than the behavioral ones.
Take a question in the back.
Area alone, there are several buildings, state buildings, and citizens. And at night, all the lights are on. And I think that that would be great as far as conservation. Also, new goals to make an entire one.
Oh, so let me just repeat the question. So first, the question was that these buildings that hold. Oh, I'm just repeating your question. The question, I think what you said was that these buildings that house all of you are the lights are left on at night, and that the wattage for these new bulbs are higher. So the.
Are they? Do they make them?
Oh, do they make them in higher wattage?
That's one question.
So yes, they do, but per lumens, that's basically what you see in terms of the quantity of light, how much light you need to be able to read something. Per lumen, it's much more efficient to use some of these LEDs than it is to use an incandescent.
I know most of them are only say, like, if you use their full evidence, you get to 100, and you can't.
Oh, no, so these are really low. I mean, some of them are 5 watts. 5 watts compared to, like, 100 watts to provide the same amount of lumen.
So the question is,
sorry, I misunderstood you. I can address that.
The question is, are you getting the same amount of light really out of that? It says it's 100 watts, or you want to buy it. So it's 120, and it only goes up to an 100-watt equivalent. And that gets at this consumer choice idea. A lot of people don't like the fact that it takes a CFL a certain amount of time to warm up. They want instant light when they flip the switch. A lot of people put them on dimmers, and they don't operate well on dimmers, if at all. So these are consumer preference challenges to implementing energy efficiency. And a lot of our spaces, at least the research shows, are overlit, but people have grown accustomed to that. Where the light is in the wrong place, the light isn't over the work surface, it's somewhere else in the room illuminating the wall. So there's a lot of research that indicates that, but yet that's a consumer preference, and people have gotten used to having overlit spaces and light cast on walls in places where they're not actually looking. And that's something that people are going to have to adjust, I think, to.
They do.
What's the highest? It's 100 watt equivalent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
I don't think so.
You have to move up to a different kind of light bulb to start getting those wattages. There was a second part to your question. Did we answer that?
About the federal buildings.
About the buildings being turned off at night. You know, I lived for 6 years in Europe, and it's interesting. You know, when I walked out of my apartment, I had to press a button to make the hall lights go on. And they stayed on for 30 seconds, and they went out. So if I didn't walk fast enough, sometimes I had to press another button on a different floor. I think those are great solutions. We do have a lot of unnecessary lighting at night and other times, and automated systems that turn the lights off are really going to be the answer to that. If you rely on people to flip the switch on the way out, it's not always going to work.
Well, that's
So what we do is that, you know, we design a program that incentivizes controls for turning lights off when no one's in the room or dimming them when no one's in the room. But we can't. Exactly. But we can't hold a gun to people's heads to make them put them in. That's our problem.
Okay, we're going to take one more question in the room and one more from the webinar.
Why don't people do with their time? In other words, society has changed. More and more people spend more and more time indoors. They're on the internet or TV. At one time, people would be outside, socializing, going to the parks, and so forth. And even with children, they're so attached to all these devices that use up energy. And the whole outer world is just lost, the parks, the landscapes, and so forth.
Or I can do whatever you want.
Sure. It is true that, and I think this is one of the reasons why the demand for electricity is ever increasing. There's more boxes, there's more bigger TVs, there's, we see this constantly, and people ask why the delivery charges are constantly going up. It's because people are constantly demanding more power, and so we have to constantly build a bigger grid to manage it. I don't know if we're going to be successful. We should certainly try and talk people into going outdoors, but I don't know how successful we're going to be at changing people's choices. So I think our best strategy is to accept that and try and find ways to make them to do that more efficiently.
And sort of also to add to that concern is that population is increasing, and a lot of developing countries look to America. Like, they look to the lifestyles of the United States, and they want to replicate them. So I grew up in the Middle East. Actually, there's an article about where my hometown, Dubai, in the New York Times today about how the environmental degradation is sort of taking place. We also have the highest CO2 footprint per capita in the world. And that's primarily because we're trying to replicate lifestyles that are very unsustainable. And so not only do we need to look at what's happening here on the ground, but we also need to figure out how to make sure that other people are not replicating our mistakes.
Okay, and we will go to our webinar participants for the last question of the afternoon.
This question is from Michael Lucas, concerning perception. Because I'm surprised to hear that general perception is that cycling makes so little difference in energy conservation. Can you speak to that? And I think that also builds on a question that I had where, how do we effectively communicate what people can do to make the biggest difference? The information is available to them, but how do we best disseminate that so people know what the most efficient use of their time and energy is?
Okay, we have a two-part question on recycling and communication.
So in terms of recycling, I think historically we've just focused a lot on recycling, the milk bottles used to be left outside your door, like not your door, but like people before us. There was this whole idea of producer take back and social responsibility. So I think that's probably why people, on the what is most effective list stated recycling quite a bit. Does that kind of answer your question?
Well, I think the person who wrote in thought that people didn't think that recycling made a very big difference. I'm wondering why still people perceive it's not very important.
That's not what we found. So we never asked people whether recycling does or does not make a difference. We just asked them to rank order how much energy goes into manufacturing recycled material. And people underestimate how much energy is saved by recycling aluminum. So that's sort of correcting the first perception. And your second question dealt with what is most effective and how do we communicate that?
Or how do we communicate?
Sure.
And there's a whole array of choices, and some are much more effective than others. How do we communicate?
That's the problem of human behavior. So your lifestyle is very different from mine. I might live very close to work. I might walk to work. I'm a vegetarian. So there are things that I do that are great, but I also fly a lot. So for me, the best, most effective thing is, how do I cut back on flying? For you, it might be different. So there's a lot of variability in terms of people's behavior. But in terms of what is most effective, just in general, for the United States, that's the paper that I was referring to. And I can send that to you and everyone else in the audience. And that's basically, things like HVAC systems, changing your thermostat settings, carpooling as much as you can, buying an efficient car, driving less. So it's a mixture of both efficiency and curtailment. But again, it is sort of tethered to what you can and cannot do in your life. So try to do the things that save the most amount of energy, but that is also applicable to you. And that's why a lot of researchers stay away from that, because it's such noisy behaviors, such noisy data. But we sort of need to start chipping away at that problem.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Chris and Shazeen, for coming today and presenting. And thank you, everyone, for coming, and everyone for joining us through the webinar. And next week, for those of you in the room, we have the climate change short course on that Tuesday. Come learn the basics of climate change and what UK is doing about it. And for those of you in the room and joining us by webinar, please stay tuned for our next Elevate Your Climate IQ event, which will be climate materials and other applications of life cycle analysis. Thank you.